Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, September 19th, 2013. This is Michael Norris. As always, I am joined by my partners in crime, Bobby Simmons and Jerry Oates. How are you guys doing this evening?
I'm doing great.
Doing wonderful, sir.
Well, good. I'm glad somebody is. It's been so hot here. I think that's why I developed this headache that I can't shake. I was in and out of the hotel today trying to not do as much and not in and out of the sun so much, but I got the advanced clowns all day tomorrow. I got a full day, so I'm trying to, we're going to do about an hour tonight, and then I'm going to bed and trying to sweep this off, whatever it is. But anyway, what's going on in Georgia? Anything new?
No, I was talking about earlier, the weather's been, on what Bobby's weather's like, but
it's been gorgeous up here. It's been like in the high 70s, very low 80s, and a lot of humidity. It's been gorgeous.
It's been nice here. It's just been hot with the humidity and everything. I was telling Jerry the day before yesterday it was 100 degrees here. Whew. Winter just does not want to get here. Summer doesn't want to let go. Before we go too far, and this is a gentleman I think both of you knew, we lost somebody else from our community this past week or just within the last couple of days, Frenchie Bernard, who was known as a manager. He managed Gorgeous George Jr., was a valet for Gorgeous George Jr. in several places, the Gulf Coast, Georgia, Florida. He managed several other people in the Mobile territory, and then he was a referee in Florida for several years. But he passed away. He was 77 years old.
Didn't he retire to take care of Andre?
Yeah, pretty much.
And then Andre left him his farm ranch and everything when he died. And then,
Yeah.
Oh, I hate that.
Yep. Well, Jerry dropped off. I don't know what happened there. But, yeah, he was 77 years old and was, as far as I know, still living there in Ellerby, North Carolina on that farm.
Yeah, Andre left him, when I heard Andre left him the farm in his will, because he had lived there and took care of Andre for so long. And that was, I'm sure he's, I hate that.
I still can't find out what his real name was. Bernard was his legit last name, but even in his obituary they put Frenchie.
I don't know.
Were you ever around him, Jerry?
Yes.
Nice guy, seemed to be, anyway. And he was, from what I understand, was pretty legitimately tough. He was a new martial arts and everything. And how he got in the wrestling business, according to Gorgeous George Jr., George was in somewhere in Canada. And there was a bar that he would frequent, and Frenchie would frequent that bar, and he would always get on to George, tell him, you know, you're fake and all this stuff like that. And so they got into a confrontation and became friends after that, and George invited him to go on the road with him. I'm not sure where the first territory he worked with George was, but he, like I said, he worked all over the place in the Southeast as a manager, referee. I think he promoted some, but anyway, like it always happens, one more gone, but at least he lived to be a ripe old age.
I can remember when I used to think that was real old. Don't seem so old now.
Yep. Andre took care of him.
Yeah, he did. He left him, like I said, he left him that ranch or farm or whatever it was there in Ellerby. And he and his wife were still living there from what his obituary said. So, He, like I said, he seemed like a nice guy. I never met him, but just in hearing people talk about him.
Yeah, a lot of respect for him.
Yeah, he was a nice man. Little man, but he was a nice guy.
Yeah. Are you working Saturday, Mr. Oates?
Sir?
Are you working Saturday?
Yes.
What time do you actually get off down there? I'm asking for a reason.
3:00.
Oh, okay, never mind. It won't work. I got a buddy of mine that's coming down there to do a wedding on the island somewhere there at 6:00. I was going to see if you could just bust the wedding up and arrest him.
I can get it handled. I promise you that.
I don't even know where they're having it at. I just know he told me, I saw this friend of mine Monday night, and he said, I asked him what he was doing this weekend. He said he had to go to Tybee Island and perform a wedding. So.
Oh, he's going to perform it?
Yes, yes.
All right. Well, if you was coming, I'd give you a pass. You could...
I did a wedding one time at Jackson Lake here, not far from the house, and I was the only person in the wedding that had shoes on. We were on they had a little private beach in the back of their house, and that's where they did the wedding, and they were all in tuxedos and fancy dresses and barefooted.
Some of these people have these weddings down there on the beach. You can get sandblasted down there.
Oh.
If that wind's blowing, that'd be the last place I'd get married.
Mm. I did a wedding a few years ago down on St. Simon's at a place called Epworth by the Sea. A little place there. It's owned by the Methodist Church. It's a hotel and has a chapel that's been there for 150 years or whatever. And they got some huge oak trees, and we did the wedding under these oak trees outdoors. That was great. I had a ball down there for a couple of days. But that was kind of a nice setting. But it wasn't out in the open where you were getting blasted with the sun and with the sand coming up.
Yeah, it can turn nasty, I'm telling you.
Oof. We haven't had to wrestle any more alligators. I haven't seen anything.
No,
in the
sir.
Paper, so
no, I think that's it. Since we're talking about it, probably 8 of them down there tomorrow.
Oh.
Well, I went this past Saturday evening and picked up Roberto Soto, and we went and visited Mr. Bowman and took him out to get something to eat. And that was fun.
How's he doing?
He's doing okay. He's frustrated more than anything else because there's nobody for him to talk to that understands what he's talking about. But he said that it was good to be around Soto and I. Of course, I had to hear Soto sing all the way.
I know that was interesting.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to get him to record Roberto Soto's greatest hits. Oh, man. But it was good. Soto's doing fine. Bill's actually doing well. He's having to be on oxygen. Well, you know, when we got there, he was in a wheelchair, and I was thinking the worst, and he had his oxygen on. But he got up and walked out and walked to my car with the help of a walker, which he really didn't use much and didn't take his oxygen with him. So he's doing okay.
That's good.
Like I said, he's, like any of us, he's been up in that nursing home, and he's about to go crazy. But he's doing well.
Has he got any family?
His son and daughter-in-law and grandson are there in Pensacola. His son was there when we got there Saturday. This place is like Fort Knox. You have to check him out, sign him out, show your ID, do this, do that. They all but fingerprinted us.
Jeez.
But it's a nice facility. Of course, he's sharing a small room with another person who doesn't communicate at all. So, and then they have no bathroom, but Bill's got a little toilet, like a baby toilet there that he has to use.
Hello.
Like I said, he's hoping to work something out where he can go somewhere else soon, but we'll see. We'll see.
Okay. All right. You ready to meet you down there?
Bobby's got somebody in the hospital.
You get home.
There's no telling.
Call me. All right, bud. Bye-bye. I don't know if he's going to make it or not. When he's down there.
Hey guys, y'all there?
Yeah,
I'm here.
I'm sorry, I had to catch another phone. I'm
that's
I got
right.
Church members just having issues.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, I talked to Mr. Smith yesterday. He's still alive and kicking. He's still working at the fair. I think he's there through Saturday or Sunday of this week, and then it's over. And he'll be turned loose on society again.
And then you guys are going, he's going with you to Nashville, right?
Yes, sir. Okay. That's next week.
Well, good luck to you. Good luck to you.
Oh, it'll be fine. He'll be fine.
At least you get to see Joe and Ken Lucas and hopefully Dennis Hall will be there.
Yeah, should be fun. I got your email yesterday about your topic tonight. I don't know if you've led into it or going to lead into it or not, but I thought it was very interesting. I'm curious to hear Jerry's take on it.
Well, you know, even as far back as the 40s and 50s, there were guys who were somewhat bodybuilders, but they weren't the steroid muscle heads like it became. I mean, you had the Stanley brothers, and you had Eric Pederson and, guys like Sailor Art Thomas came along in the 50s, Earl Maynard in the 60s, and guys like that. But I think the real musclehead phase kicked off when superstar Billy Graham became so popular. I mean, he was on every magazine, and Death Senior put the belt on him and everything. And then, then the Hogan era and the Road Warriors and stuff like that. But at least with guys like, Graham, he somewhat would take bumps and would sell and stuff like that, but wasn't the greatest worker in the world. But then, after the Road Warriors came along and Ole told them not to sell anything or, take any bumps or anything like that, it seemed like every territory that was left had to have an imitation Road Warriors team, and it's just, everybody had face paint, wore leather, and had spikes and had dumb names and, But, there's a difference, at least in my opinion, and I'm interested in getting your guys' takes. There's a difference in being fit and being in shape and being able to wrestle and being, so bulky you can't do anything. I mean, Lou Fez was in shape. Danny Hodge was in shape. You couldn't find any fat on either one of them. Same with Jack Briscoe. But you look at the difference in those guys and somebody like Graham, Billy Graham, and it's just, it seemed to go more towards the muscle head and more toward looks and aesthetics as opposed to ability and skill. I don't know whether you guys agree with that or not.
Talking about guys with great bodies, of course, I never saw Eric Pederson, but they said he was unbelievable in the ring.
Yeah. And I never saw him work.
No, I didn't either. He competed in the Mr. Universe along with Andre Drop.
Yep.
And the winner of that contest was Steve Reeves.
Yep.
Andre Drop was second, Eric Pederson was third. But, Compati had a good body.
Yeah.
There was a lot of guys that had good, real good bodies. Probably in my day, the guy that had, to me, a great body that could work was Snooker.
Yeah.
And he was a bodybuilder at one time. He was Mr. Hawaii at one time, even though he was from Fiji. He won the Miss Hawaii, but he was unbelievable in that ring. He's one of the smoothest guys I ever stepped in a ring with. But there was, you know, there was
Don Fargo was another, you know.
Yeah, he was another one. I heard he could really work. You know, there were guys. I mean, you know, of course, guys got bigger as time went on, but later on, the bigger they got, the less they could work. You know, they really wasn't worried about that part of the craft. It was just, you know, how big I can be. You know, and like it or not, those guys got the pushes. You know.
Yep.
Yep.
I thought about this thing after I read your topic, and I don't know if you guys will agree with this or not, but I got to thinking about it. TV, which was the greatest asset the wrestling business had in the 50s for the rejuvenation of the wrestling business, I can't talk. It got it back on TV. It got it back in the eye. And we had, the greatest years of our business, I think, were the late 50s, the 60s, most of the 70s, even maybe into the early 80s. I think that was the greatest era of our business. But I think TV became our worst enemy after a while because we were so successful and everybody was doing such great business that we came right back to that same thing where everybody was trying to downgrade our business, talk about our business, you know, display us as circus freaks or whatever you want to call us. And I think the trend went to the bodybuilders to try to legitimize our business again. And the promoter said, well, this is a way we can do it by putting these bodybuilders, you know. I mean, Hulk Hogan worked here, well, he was Sterling Golden. He worked here 2 weeks and he got fired because he couldn't wrestle. I think it became our own worst enemy. And we probably did it to ourselves. Again, Road Warriors were awesome looking guys, but to tell guys not to sell. I know I had a run in with Zulu one night after a match. He had a match with Jerry Blackwell, and he didn't sell anything Blackwell did. And we come out of the ring, and of course Zulu always wanted confirmation of how good he was, and he asked me. He said, "What did you think of the match?" And I said, "I thought it was horrible." And he said, "Why?" I said, if you believe those people are buying that big man there can't hurt you, I said, we got a problem. So, you know, I mean, you put Jerry Oates in a ring with the Road Warriors, are you telling me Jerry can't hurt those guys?
Well, Bobby, a lot of that fell on the bookers.
Whoever. Exactly.
I mean, they created monsters.
Yes, they sure did.
It got out of hand.
Oh, it got way ahead. Yeah. And, you know, some of these guys, especially, and I found it more so, you know, I know and you know and Michael knows and anybody that's ever been in a ring knows, a guy that's 5.5 feet tall that looks like a wino can pull your lungs out through your ears.
That's right.
You know, he doesn't, it's all in knowing what you're doing. And these guys that got those kind of pushes and were told, don't sell, don't do this, be Superman, a lot of those guys got to believe in their own publicity.
That's what happened. And it made it worse. and their learning of what we do got less.
Yes. They didn't have to learn it.
But they didn't have to learn it.
They did not have to learn it. And a lot of those guys, and God knows, I was the luckiest guy in the world. I was in the right place at the right time, and of course I didn't break in as a wrestler. I broke in as a referee. So but there's guys that, I mean, they paid heavy dues to get in this business. You know, Dickie, your own brother-in-law didn't make it easy on you. I mean, you worked hard to get in this business, and some of these guys just simply because they had these huge bodies. Some promoter sees them and goes, "Hey, I can turn a dollar with this guy." I mean, they didn't pay any dues. They didn't have any appreciation of what we did or how we did it, and didn't care.
No, I think that's
Luger. God bless him for the shape he's in now, but he was another prime example. Looked unbelievable.
Yeah.
looked unbelievable.
Until he locked up with somebody.
Well, there you go.
And the thing about him, what I always heard about him, he didn't want to learn. He thought, you know, I've got $1 million body. You know, I don't need to learn. I don't need to know the history of this business. I'm only in it for a buck. You know, and that's all well and good. I mean, we were all in it. Bottom line, we were all in it to make money. But still, some of us had more of a pride of the history and the, you know, of everything in the business. So,
but you know, I don't know how far back it went. I know I got in it because I loved it.
Yeah, me too.
And I always figured, you know, the better I got, the more money I would make instead of how much money am I going to make. You know, I figured, of course, I got in at a time when, you know, there's a lot of wrestling going on. And then that kind of faded away, but, you know, later on. But you take teams like Tom and Jody. There wasn't a better team ever than those two.
No.
And you know, the psychology that those two had, and, you know, these guys that we've spoken of here, just like with Logan, the psychology, they didn't need to know it, I guess. I don't know. I don't know. They was going to be pushed regardless.
Yeah.
And usually, if a promotion was smart and you had somebody like that, of course, you had to put guys that could work with them.
If they had to carry them.
Is that fair?
No, it's not.
You know, yeah. I mean, it's really sad.
Well, and I'll tell you something else that happened, too. And I think I've heard Ted talk about this in the Carolinas a little bit when you guys were up there, and I know y'all were making a lot of money. But you'd have to put a semifinal out there, and they'd have to go 45 or 50 minutes every night because the main event was going in there, and you knew it wasn't going over 10, 12 minutes.
Well, that was our spot every night.
That's what I've heard him talk about that.
Was our spot.
Yeah, because, you know, you couldn't, the guys on top, the big guys and the guys that didn't know how to work, you know, they couldn't, you know, what are they going to do?
And
certain
and
things
really,
they do, and that's what you're going to do, and that's it.
But really, I took that as a compliment in a way because
yeah.
George Scott knew we could do it.
Yep.
You know, that was, but and we made money in that slot, you know.
Yep.
But that was our slot. Everybody had a slot. But I was making more money than I ever made
yeah.
up there. So, you know, that was all right, too.
Well, I look back, and you know, the muscle, the big body guys, they were the attraction, but the guys that could work were the guys that they used every week to make the money with. And it just somehow or another that flip-flopped. And we've talked about it in weeks past about some of the guys that didn't have the great bodies but were just fantastic wrestlers. They kind of got pushed to the side.
Yeah, they got lost in the shuffle.
Yes, and that was, it's very sad. It's very sad. I mean, you know, God love him. Charlie Fulton did not have a great body. Charlie Fulton was straight up and down. He weighed about 220, but Charlie was straight up and down. One of the best hands I've ever been around. Charlie did anything you asked him to do, never said a word, went out, worked hard every night. But if you had put Charlie, and, you know, he wore black trunks, black boots, you know, had a little ring jacket, nothing flashy. There was nothing flashy about Charlie. But Charlie did a great job day in, day out. But that, in today's market, wouldn't fly.
And the beauty part about it, he worked every night, though.
Yes,
he did.
What I mean. Yes, he did. So.
Yeah, and just like with the big bodies and everything became, you know, built around a catchphrase that they could put on a T-shirt and sell T-shirts. I know that's a sore subject with you, Jerry, but.
Well, I'm the exception here.
And, you know, everything was.
Thanks
to
Bobby Simmons.
You know,
we're trying to help him make a comeback in that market, but anyway.
You know, so and so.
You guys
was a good wrestler,
remember
but he
the Warlord.
Yeah.
Or who?
Warlord.
The Warlord, yeah, I remember, yes, I do.
Well, I mean, what a monster he was.
Ooh.
Mm, but,
yeah.
You know, how far could you go with that? How long could you go with that?
Yeah.
Exactly.
That was the... It was more like an oddity.
Yeah, I mean, that would be like having Andre or Haystack Calhoun or Man Mountain Mike in your territory week in and week out. You know, eventually, they're going to do everything they're going to do.
Yeah, I love Haystack. He was a great guy, but he got a 2-week run every summer, and that was it.
But you know, there was a slot for him.
Yes,
there
was.
And it was okay.
Yep.
And that was okay, too.
Yep.
You just look back and you just, of course, you know, we all know what happened, but, you know, you can go on YouTube and look at some matches and you just, my gosh, where did that go? Where did that go?
Now, Jerry, you worked with Jesse Ventura a lot. What was he, I mean, I know he wasn't the most skilled in the world, but as far as, you know, his feelings towards the business and everything, how was he?
You were talking about in the ring?
Well, that and just his overall attitude towards being in the wrestling business.
Of course, he wanted to be Billy Graham.
Yeah.
And I know we went to Kansas City, and Eddie Sharkey trained him, and he started at Kansas City.
Yeah.
And we hauled him and, you know, traveled with him and worked with him some and real green. And then later on, he left there and went to Oregon. And then he had a good run out there. And then I went to Oregon later on, and he was still there.
I agree.
And then he left there and went back to Minneapolis, where he's from. So... He worked on a spot show at Bethel Burn. On a spot show, and got $1,700 and quit.
Wow.
You know, there was a lot of guys that they thought the business owed them something, you know. And Jesse, the best thing that ever happened to Jesse, I mean, it's horrible to say, is when he got hurt out in California. And he got a horrible blood clot in his leg, and he was in the hospital. And so Vince asked him if he wanted to do some commentating, and the rest was history. He made more money as a commentator than he did in the ring. And then WCW hired him.
The thing about him was he teamed with somebody who didn't have a great body, was one of the best workers I ever saw, best bump takers, Adrian Adonis. You know, he could have learned so much from teaming with him. And they were a successful team, but I think Adonis carried that team more than
Ventura. Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And you know, the business wound up, by him being in the business, wound up being good for him. You know, he was on a couple of movies. And he got known, and it was because of the wrestling business. And then became a governor. I mean, how much stronger does that get, you know?
And now he's in Mexico hiding from UFOs. he's lost his mind, I believe.
He may be on a UFO. I don't know. But, you know, a lot of guys, you know, Bobby Simmons, I'm sure, Mike Norris, you got in the business because you wanted to be in it.
Yep.
You wanted to be in it. And once you got in it, I know it, like for me, it was like a dream. It was a dream come true. You know?
Yep.
And you appreciated it, and you just wanted to be as good as you could be, and, you know, watch the different guys. But there were a lot of guys with good bodies, you know, not Earl Maynard. He was a very nice guy. I don't know if you was ever around him.
Yeah.
Earl was a very nice guy. He was a Mr. Universe.
I've been racking my mind all afternoon. Who was the other guy? He started in Mexico, but he was big up in the Northeast in the early 60s and then was big in California. I can't think of his name.
You talking about Real Good Body?
Yeah.
He's from Mexico.
No, he wasn't from Mexico. He was from Trinidad, but he got his start in Mexico.
From Trinidad.
At least that's where they called him the Calypso Kid. I can't think of what his name is.
You're not talking about...
Dory Dixon. Dory Dixon, that's who it was.
Dory Dixon, yeah.
Yeah. You had Sailor Art Thomas, poor sailor.
The poor sailor. I'll tell you another one that I had a good buddy was Sweet Daddy Siki.
Yep. Yep.
I thought he was going to say Sweet Daddy Levi Banks, but I never met
Dory Dixon. I never met him.
He was big in Mexico, worked in the Northeast in the 60s, worked in California for a while in the 70s, and then I think he retired to Mexico. I think that's where he is now. Well, Bobby, at least he didn't say Sweet Daddy Watts.
Oh, I heard that.
Was you around him,
too.
Bobby?
Who?
Sweet Daddy Watts.
Gorilla Watts, yes.
Yeah. You ought to hear Ted Oates imitate him.
Oh, yeah, I've heard it. Oh. We were working for Ann. It's probably 73, 74. We were sitting in Manchester, Georgia in the dressing room. Dick was running the town. And he had bought about a 59 or a 60 Ford Fairlane. And he was sitting in the dressing room, and he stuttered horribly. And he was telling about this new car he had bought. Well, we'd done seen it. We knew it was, a 20 years old or whatever. Dick comes in the dressing room and sits down next to him and starts laying it on him about what he ought to do with his car. He told him he ought to take it to Stone Mountain on Sunday on the day off and take his girlfriend and pack a picnic. He said, and then you ought to get your wax out, get it under a tree. And he said, people be looking at it, and you wax it and shine it up. And son, he was eating it up. Yeah. He just kept on. Dick led him right down the path. And when he finally got him down to the end of the path, he said, then you ought to drive it to the top of the mountain and drive it right off the side.
I knew where you was going with that.
They brought him in the Mobile in late 73 and put him on top. Of course, he couldn't talk, so they had him. He was working heel, so they had him with Al Galento. And they put him in a program with Mike Boyette, of all people. You talk about the blind leading the blind. And then they brought him back later in 74 as a baby face.
I paid to see him and Boyette.
They were decent matches. They weren't the best in the world, but they were decent matches. Of course, you couldn't get Watts off his feet. Once you got him off his feet, the match was over because he couldn't get up. And his finishing hole was a front face lock, and I thought to myself, ooh, I'd hate to be there.
Ooh.
You know what? He was from Paducah.
Yep.
He called it Duca.
Paducah, Kentucky. He would get dressed. He would have to get dressed at home. He had a girlfriend, and he would get dressed at home, and when he'd get to the town, he'd come in the dressing room and he wore one of them Tarzan outfits of that remember that 5-0 material that K&H sold?
Yes.
Like the Samoans would wear . He wore one of them, that 5-0 material, and he would get there, and he would have to, he'd get in the dressing room, make sure everybody was dressed, then he'd get the girlfriend to come in there, and he'd sit down in the chair, and she'd have to pull his pants off over them boots, because he'd have his boots on. She'd have to lace the boots up for him at home, I'm sure.
Oh.
And have to pull his pants off, because he couldn't get them off.
Did you know that Joker was hard looking though? He was hard.
Oh yeah.
Is he still living?
I doubt it. I don't know.
His real name was Henderson. P.J. Henderson. I don't know what the
it
P.J.
was what?
For, but Henderson.
P.J. Henderson.
P.J. Henderson, yep.
P.J. I never heard that before.
P.J. P.J. Now, I don't know what the P.J. stood for. But then the last time he worked at Mobile, they brought him back in 70. They had brought Abdullah in for a special card to work against Big Bad John in Dothan. It was the only town Abdullah worked. And then he got over so well, about 3 months later, they brought Watts in, shaved his head, put on a pair of white jeans and fringed up the bottoms of them, and sent him out there, called him the Butcher.
Oh, come on.
Jeez.
Nope. You know, Abdullah was not the tallest in the world, but then, you know, Watts was only about 4.5 feet tall and wide. But that didn't last very long. That lasted about a month, I think. And then after that, I don't know whatever became of him. I don't know if he quit the business or went in. I never heard of him going anywhere else. But
I met him in Kansas City. He wasn't there long at all. Oh, he was something.
Yeah, he was. Well, I can't tell that on the radio. Never mind. But I was going to say, you just had to be around him to see some of his habits.
Oh God!
Yeah, it was gross. It was gross.
Well, that's what I said. I can't imagine being in, working a match with him, putting me in a front face lock half the match. His mud flaps would fall over and smother you.
Oh. Who got him in the game?
I have no clue. Probably Phil Golden, since he promoted out there in Paducah. That was the first territory I know of him ever working, when Phil Golden was running opposition to Gulas and Welch, and had Saul Weingroff booking for him. That was probably 71, 72. No, I take that back. Now, he was in around earlier than that. He was in Arizona in the 60s.
Who?
Late 60s. He worked out there.
You're kidding.
Nope.
So you're saying nobody's taking credit for this? Is that what you're saying?
Jim wasn't in existence back in the 60s, so... We can't get hung with this one.
Well, you've never heard anybody take credit for Ron Pope either, have you?
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder how that happened.
There again, he had $1 million look. You know, he got
Where
put
was
over
from?
In every territory. Detroit, Cincinnati, somewhere around there. Somewhere in around the Sheik's territory. I think the Sheik man broke him in. I'm not sure. Not real sure. But, you know, he had $1 million body, but couldn't work worth a lick.
I mean,
one of those
I don't even know what you could do with him. I mean, I know
what Lee Fields did with him. Lee Fields fired him. Because he tried to hold Lee up for more money, you know. He wasn't gonna wrestle unless he got more money, and so Lee said, "Well, bye," and had the police escort him right on out of the building.
Yeah, that's the way you work that.
Yeah, he did that just about everywhere he went.
Now I'll tell you, another guy that had a great body and didn't make a dime with it till he changed his body was Putski, Ivan Putski.
Yeah.
I don't know if y'all knew him when he was.
When he did the Mighty Eagle gimmick. I mean, that's how he started in Texas. I mean, I think, I don't know if it was Fritz or who he was working for out there, but they put him in the Mighty Eagle gimmick, and, you know, he worked as that. And then when he went to work for Vern, he finally dropped that gimmick, and then when he went to New York, he, he slimmed up tremendously. But he was never a great worker to begin with either.
No, I knew him in 70 in Florida when he was Joe Benarski.
Yeah, Hercules Benarski, yeah.
Oh, he had an unbelievable body. Unbelievable.
Well, there was a guy that never got a lot of push anywhere, and he mainly worked even back in the 50s. All he worked was prelim and mid-card. You mentioned Tampa. Was Harry Smith. You remember him?
Oh, yeah. He had a gym in Tampa.
There
and,
yeah.
Yeah, Harry Smith looked great.
I'll tell you a guy that worked with us at Gunkel that had a good body, and, of course, he got out of the business and became a movie star or a TV star, was Jack Armstrong.
Yep.
Bobby, after he left here, what was the deal with him?
Who, Jack?
Yeah.
He went to California. He went to Los Angeles, and he worked out there a while, and then he started getting some TV bits. Finally just got out of the business and started doing that. He comes to Vegas every year. He looks great. Looks the same.
Well, another one that people don't think of as having a great body, but what you were talking about, Jerry, being rock solid, was Toru Tanaka. I bet
you could
break the board over his shoulders.
Oh, come on, man. That man was dangerous. Ooh. And what a nice man he was. Now, he was an impressive-looking guy.
Yes, he was.
You couldn't tell it by just pictures of him that you saw him live, and then you realized how big he was.
Oh, it was unbelievable.
He was a monster.
You know, Bobo looked good.
Yeah,
he did.
He looked good up until his 70s.
Tanaka was very tame when Fuji put that marijuana in his skull tobacco. He put that stuff in his mouth in the dressing room. Fuji just die laughing. He'd sit right there in the chair and go to sleep. You'd have to wake him up and go, Charlie, they're ringing the bell.
What a prince of a fella he was.
Yes, he was.
Well, he got Mr. Simmons drunk on an airplane.
Oh, geez. I don't know what he... I hyperextended my elbow on a Saturday night, and I got up Sunday morning, and it was swollen, and I was hurting bad. I was crying. I mean, it was killing me, and I had to go to Savannah. And unfortunately, back then, it wasn't like today where you could call in and say you've hurt your elbow, and they'd give you 6 weeks off with pay. I had to go get on an airplane and go to Savannah. And I was sitting there. I mean, I was in tears. I was hurting. And he was sitting behind me. As soon as we got up in the air, he leaned up at me and go, "Hey, brother." He said, "What's the matter?" And I told him. He said, I'll take care of you. And he told the stewardess something, and she brought me something, and he said, "Here, drink this." I said, "What is it?" He said, "It don't matter. Just drink it." And I did. And when I got to Savannah, I didn't even know I had an elbow. But it got me through the day.
Well, another one in that same vein was Saito. Saito was another brick.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I don't know if either one of y'all ever had that pleasure.
Oh,
I never
yes.
worked with him. I refereed a lot of his matches.
I wrestled.
See, that wasn't a joke. That was no joke.
He took care of me, I'll have to say. He wasn't all that rough with me, but I've seen him jump on some fans that were... Well, I've seen some fans jump on him and realize quickly the error of their ways.
That would be a big mistake. That's the first time I ever got knocked out. I got knocked out wrestling him in Florida.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he threw me out of the ring. I mean, he actually physically threw me out of the ring. And when I went through between the top and the second, I was going so fast, the side of my face caught the apron. I thought I broke my jaw. It knocked me spark out.
Ooh. Ooh. The funniest thing that ever happened with me and him happened outside the ring. We're sitting in a pizza restaurant in Parkersburg, West Virginia, and I won't mention who was with us, but he was talking to this young lady, and he started screaming at the young lady, and Fado looked at me just plain matter-of-factly, and he went, "We're going to jail." And I went, "No, we're not. I have the car keys. Let's go." Well, didn't he one Saito, the one that wasn't it him and Patera that got a little jail time for breaking up a McDonald's or something?
Yep. So
well, it wasn't
throwing rocks
necessarily that. It was beating all those cops up.
Ooh.
Yep.
Now, they said those Bilajan brothers had good bodies.
Yeah, they all did. The Bilajans, yeah. They all did.
Well, were they good
they
workers?
Were all freaks.
I heard
it. I never saw any of them work, but everybody that I know that ever saw them or worked with them thought they were great. But they were freakishly, especially Adrian. He looked like he had that acro, whatever it is, that Baba had,
and
Andre had. Yeah. I mean, he was tall and you know, muscular, but he had a real long face. And, well, they were all nothing to look at, nothing right home about as far as beauties, but they were all, of course, they were gymnasts in Canada, and they were well-known before they got in the wrestling business as being Olympians.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. They were all from Montreal. Now, Adrian, he booked Louisiana for Harry Romero back in the 60s and then stayed on when Lee bought out Romero. Lee Fields bought out there, and he just, you know, he wanted to book himself on top and everything, and he just wasn't drawing, so finally they got rid of it. But then he stayed in that area, and then when Lee sold back out to whoever, I don't know if it was McGurk or who it was, but he came back and was booking down there. As far as I know, that's where he stayed until he died, was in Louisiana. But there were six or seven of those brothers. And you see, Lionel, Adrian, Tony, oh, there was a couple others that got in the wrestling business. There were at least five or six that were in the wrestling business.
No kidding.
Yeah. Let's see, there was Lionel, Paul, Tony, Charles, Adrian. And there were six of them all together when they were gymnasts. So they may have all six gotten in wrestling business. I don't know.
Well, I don't think that, you know, Vince has got a lot of freak-looking guys now, you know, because you got the Big Show. He's just a big guy. You got some guys that look good. Dusty was on there Monday night.
Oh, good, was he?
Yeah.
But that's
somebody called me.
That's the difference of back in our era. I mean, you could take somebody like Dusty who didn't have the greatest body in the world, but people believed in him because they believed he was a tough guy. And, you know. But, and he drew a ton of money without
this
being superstar
it.
Billy Graham. You know, but I think that's that was the case. You look at guys like Lawler and, you know, the Gulf Coast Territory, you had Kelly and guys like that who looked just like normal everyday guys, and that's what got the people behind them, in my opinion. You know, they wanted to see people just like them to do things that they would wish they could do. But then you go to every independent show now, and they all want to look like, you know, every you look on Facebook, all these independent guys who post pictures of themselves, they've all got, you know, their head shaved or got the same tattoo. They all stick their tongue out, just like.
Some guy that's on my Facebook, it was just, I just had to do it. He's covered in tattoos. He's never done a push-up in his life. I told him, I wrote on there, I said, if you had bought a gym membership instead of spending all that money on tattoos, you might be ahead of the game. It was just, I just shake my head. I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess I can make a comeback if I get me a weed eater.
I guess so. Well, I still want to do the pressure washer thing if I can sell rain suits at the gimmick table.
Well, let me tell you something. Do you know what a pressure washer will do to you?
Oh, yes, I do. We can't do much more than a weed eater. I mean, these guys are nuts.
Bobby, can you imagine? I wouldn't even go watch something like that, would you?
No. I mean, I just, you know, to me and you coming up, the most extreme thing we could see was a cage match.
Exactly.
It was a cage. You put them in a cage where they can't get out. And then of course, every once in a while, I don't know if they ever did it in Columbus or not, but a couple times in Atlanta, they put barbed wire around a ring, which was really extreme.
Do you know what barbed wire will do to you?
Oh, yes, sir. I certainly do. I had to put some on a cage one time for Abdullah and the Sheik, and then I had to referee it. Yeah, I know exactly what it'll do to you.
Ooh. I just...
I wouldn't even want to be in the ring with those two. Those two are too masochistic.
Well, I refereed probably, I don't know, 10 or 12 matches, I guess, between those two. It always wound up, we were in the crowd, and even though I'm just the referee, I was out there trying to watch their back as best I could, you know. Charlie Wright, who was the head of security for us, he was a lieutenant on the Atlanta Police Department. He was smart. We would tell him what we were doing, so he had some idea. None of the guys that worked for him did, but he would put them in places where they would be in the right place where, you know. But, I mean, those guys were just, you never knew what they were going to do.
You know, it's the one thing that cut all the pieces one night.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. And the only reason they didn't is I don't think, you know, I think the crowd wanted them to kill each other because it was never a babyface heel situation with those two. They didn't like either one of them. And,
right.
You know, I always got along with Abby Fine, so I was pulling for Abby to kill him, but, you know, I couldn't tell nobody that. But it was just a, you know, just a, that was, there again, that was a gimmick match. You know, I mean, Abdullah's another example. Now, there's not a great body, but there's a guy that was able to stay in his territory, and through good bookers, they were able to manipulate some matches where he was able to, you know, work here on a regular basis. But, and there were some strange things we did back then. But yeah, the extreme stuff was the cage. I mean, we...
Oh, that was a big deal then, Buzz.
Yes, it was. I mean, that was like... After they've tried everything else, lights out, Texas death match, I mean, you know, you'd work a guy, they'd work that deal for 4, 5, 6 weeks before they ever got to the cage. And it was, you know. I don't know about Columbus because I never saw one when you were going down there, but the first cage I ever saw in Atlanta was made out of 2x2s and chicken wire.
Uh-huh.
And it was tied on the ring.
That's a lost art now, building up to a cage match.
Sure it is. Now they have them just so they can have them. I mean, of course, you know, they got one hanging over the ring. They just lower it down.
Yep.
Well, yeah, I was going to say they have three or four on a card because, you know, they got to make use of it since it's out there anyway. Might as well use it. But, you know, going back talking about the Sheik, and I don't know, I never saw, you know, I've seen video of him, but I don't know how in the world he kept that territory going for as long as he did when it was the same thing over and over. He'd work a 3-minute match, get disqualified, never lose his title.
I'm going to tell you something, though. Those people up there believed in him. They believed
in him.
They thought he was crazy. Well, crap, I thought he was crazy, too, but... I mean,
how many matches do you think him and Bobo had at Cobo Arena?
Oh, geez.
St- 1,000.
Yeah.
If not more.
I'm like you. I don't know how he did it. I really don't.
I guess the people just hated him so much they wanted to see him get beat. So they would show up hoping somebody would beat him. And every once in a while he'd throw him a crumb and, you know, Bobo would beat him or Lord Layton would beat him or, you know. But, and believe it or not, he could wrestle. If you go back and find video of him in the 50s, he was a decent worker.
Yeah, when he first started, he sure was.
But I guess it's just like anything else. You get to, you know, you do as little as you can since it's your territory and you're getting paid anyway. So.
Who had that before him, Mike?
Detroit. Who had Detroit before him? It might have been part of Barnett's when Barnett had Indianapolis. I don't know if Detroit was part of that or not.
When did he take possession of that? Do you know?
Early 60s. It was always in his father-in-law's name, Francis Fletcher. But it was I think he took it over in 63, 64, something like that. But, you know, Detroit has a large Arab population anyway, so.
Yes.
Well, you know, in the 60s and even up into the early 70s, you know, there was a lot of good talent went through there up there, and he took care of them. And then he quit paying guys, and guys quit going up there.
Where did
you go there, Gary? Bobo lived there, and I'm sure he took care of Bobo, but.
Yeah. You weren't there long, were you, Gary? What, a couple weeks maybe?
No, I was up there longer. I'd go up there just on the weekends.
Okay.
And I got my big match.
Were you working for the Sheik?
Yeah. I worked with him at the first wrestling match they had at the Joe Louis Arena. I was on the main event with the Sheik. If you think that wasn't a fright, I didn't even break a sweat. It was
the match last about 3 minutes?
It wasn't much more than that, Mike.
Long enough for him to gig and
yep.
Was Creechman managing him then, or was that
he wasn't there.
Okay.
But he, you know, Don Kent was up there. You knew Don, didn't you?
Yeah, I knew Don Kent. Yes.
A nice man.
Oh yeah, Don
he
Kent.
Was
it was him. It was him and Steve Clemens. It was with me that the guy told him to kick the motorcycle out of gear. It was Ken on one side putting the boots on the motorcycle.
Don was a nice guy.
But, you know, Don lived up there, and I imagine that she stayed there forever.
Yeah, the only other place he ventured.
Mike, I don't mean to interrupt. I got
to recommend,
okay?
All right. Probably never gets a break.
Bobby.
I think he's on the other line. Jerry.
Oh, he's on the other line. How many other places did he work besides? I know he'd come to Georgia every so often. Did he go to other territories like that?
Yeah, he worked in Tennessee. He and the Kangaroos, he and Costello went as the Kangaroos, and they had Clemens with them, and then they brought in Cannon. He worked, he would work in Toronto. But Toronto and Detroit, they kind of had a deal worked out there until Crockett started running Toronto. He worked in Florida, worked in the Caribbean, Puerto Rico, came through Mobile in the late 50s, early 60s.
Really?
Worked in Texas some, yeah. But he did the majority of his traveling when he and Costello were the Kangaroos. And then after Costello decided to retire, he managed the Kangaroos, and Kent and Bob De La Sera, who they call Bob Heffernan, works as the Kangaroos.
He used to go to Japan, too.
Yeah, I'm sure he did, yeah. Never got to see. Well, I take that back. I have seen him work on video, and he was a good worker.
But, at one time, he could. But like you said, I guess he figured out what no future in that. I'll just go the other way,
yeah.
I guess.
Yep.
He was something else.
You talking about Sheik or Kent?
The Sheik.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he was still working in Japan when he was 70-something years old, him and Abdullah. You know. But he definitely lived that gimmick, lived in that converted hotel that he converted into a house. But, you know, he was from the Detroit area. He was from Lansing or somewhere around that way. He went to the University of Michigan, played football there.
Did he
for
really?
Them. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
There for them. Was in the military. I can't remember what branch he was in. I want to say he was in the Army. And then he became the Sheik. Oh, that was another one that was on every magazine.
Oh, there's no doubt.
I never got to see him work live. He was like, well, there again, talking about somebody that had a $1 million body that was actually a good worker when he felt like it was Mil Máscaras. But the first time I saw him after he jumped over the top rope and took his cape off, it was over.
It was over. Did you know he was Mr. Mexico?
Yeah. Yep.
His work was, you know, I guess for down there, that was okay. But
the first match I ever seen him in was him against Larry Hamilton, the Missouri Mauler.
Oh, my God.
It was awful. Larry was so mad when he came out of the ring, he could have bit nails. And he just, I mean, you know, like you say, the, you know, his big deal to end was, you know, the big leap off the top rope, the cross body block. But he would climb up on the top rope and he would pose. And he'd want you to stand there and just wait on him to jump. And, I mean, it was crazy.
He drew big money in Houston for Paul Bosch.
Yes, he did. Well, he was big in Japan, too.
Yeah. I was in Japan with him.
The first time I ever saw him, he was in Tampa, and they had him and Skip Young team together against, I want to say it was the Hollywood Blondes, Brown and Roberts. And Skip Young worked his tail off that match. I was more impressed with Skip Young. I'd never seen him before. I was more impressed with him than I was Máscaras.
Skip was an unusual guy, but he could work. Skip could.
Yep.
Yeah, he was a good worker. And his flying stuff was actually better than Máscaras, in my opinion.
Didn't Skip Young pass away?
Yep.
Yeah, a couple of years ago. Last year, year before, something like that.
You know, Máscaras, everything he did was in slow motion because it was all about how it looked rather than how it was perceived.
Exactly.
Well, that whole thing, that whole gimmick came along. He was actually the second Mil Máscaras. That character was a comic book hero or cartoon hero or whatever in Mexico, and they wanted to find somebody to fill that role to get in the wrestling business. And like I said, he was the second one. I don't know how long the first one lasted, but he took it over in the early 60s. And he was a new jiu-jitsu. And so they stuck with that. That character, it was more of a character to sell movies than it was to wrestle. I guess that's why he never, you know. Again, and it depends on who he worked with. I've seen video of him working with Dick Beyer, and it's a beautiful match. And both of them are fantastic. Of course, with Dick Beyer, you don't have much choice but to work.
And, well, he made a fortune.
Jack Briscoe always loved to work with him.
Harley told me he went to his house in Mexico. He said he lived like a king.
Oh, I would imagine so.
I mean, he made big money. He made big money everywhere he went, man. He made big money in Japan. He went all over the world. But he was one of those guys, if you saw him once, that was enough.
Yeah.
But he made a fortune doing it, you know. What can I say?
Well, guys, I'm going to wrap it up so I can lay my head down and try and get rid of this headache before tomorrow. Tomorrow's going to be a long day. And,
well, I hope you get feeling better, Mike.
Next week, Bobby will be in Nashville. He's going to try and join us at some point, but sitting in for him is going to be our friend Jay West. So it'll be Jay, Jerry, and I next week, and with field report from Mr. Simmons from Nashville. So I'll have to come up with a subject that Jay can work with us on. But guys, I appreciate it as always, and we'll get together next week and we'll do this again.
Sounds good. Hey, have a good time, fellas.
Y'all have a blessed week.
Thanks. Good night.
You too. Good night, everybody.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.